We've got the minutes before us for January 24th. Representative Sundin, would you move the minutes, please?
Mr. Chairman, I move the minutes of January 24th of this committee.
Thank you. Any additions or corrections to the minutes? Hearing none, the minutes are approved. We are on TV today, so make sure your ties are straight. First item on the agenda, Commissioner Thornton is here, and he's going to take us through the Volkswagen settlement, and I see Ms. Gauthier is here, too. So please introduce yourselves and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is David Thornton. I'm Assistant Commissioner at the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Greta Gauthier, Legislative Director at the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. And if I may just point out to members, we did pass out a fact sheet this morning, so if that might be a handy reference for folks.
So, Mr. Chairman, thank you for inviting us here today to talk about the Volkswagen settlement. This has been in the news for the last 6 or 7 months. There's a lot of information swirling around, and there are multiple court cases involving Volkswagen and what they did with diesel engines. But I'm here primarily to talk about the environmental mitigation settlement and how it affects Minnesota. But if you have questions about some of the other issues, I can try to answer them as well.
Thank you, Commissioner. And I think that the focus is on what's going on here in Minnesota. The court case is the court case, and I'm not a lawyer, so I'd like to stay awake.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So what happened? Volkswagen intentionally tampered with their diesel engines, their 2-liter and their 3-liter engines, to fool emissions testing equipment. The result of that was that they exceeded their tailpipe emission standards by more than 30 times for nitrogen oxides over the past 7 years. This affects model years starting with 2009. Nationwide, there are about 580,000 of these vehicles on the roads. In Minnesota, we believe that there were around 9,300 of these diesel Volkswagens registered in the state. And the amount of excess emissions in Minnesota has occurred over time is the equivalent of having an additional 300,000 cars on the road. So it's a significant amount of air pollution. There was a nationwide lawsuit brought against Volkswagen for these violations, initiated by the state of California and joined by US EPA and the Department of Justice. They charged that Volkswagen illegally tampered with their emission control systems and falsified federal emission tests. And again, this is for the 2-liter and 3-liter engines. Volkswagen essentially had some software built into their computers on board these cars so that they programmed the vehicles to bypass emission control equipment when the vehicles were being tested. And then they ran with a little bit more energy and power when they were being driven by their owners. And this went on, as I said, for many years, going back to as far as 2009. We weren't following any of this case. We weren't involved in it directly. We didn't have anything to do with the settlement. We weren't consulted in any way. So when the draft settlement came out in July, it actually caught us and most states completely by surprise. The environmental mitigation settlement that Volkswagen agreed to is going to cost them $14.9 billion. There's other settlements that they've agreed to as well. They've agreed to a penalty. There's some other things that are still pending. But for the environmental mitigation settlement, the total is $14.9 billion. $10 billion of that is for the repurchase or the repair of the defective vehicles that they sold. Volkswagen is already in the process of buying back these subject vehicles, which will then be destroyed and recycled. The buyback price that they are offering is generous. It's above what you would call a blue book price. And I think that the hope is that most of the owners of these vehicles will sell them back to Volkswagen, but they can choose to have the vehicle repaired and continue to operate it.
Mr. Chairman, if I may add here that this $10 billion is going through Volkswagen dealerships directly to the people that bought the cars, the defective cars. It's not connected with our agency at all.
Thank you.
And then, Mr. Chairman, $2 billion of the settlement is for zero-emission vehicle infrastructure. Volkswagen is largely responsible for that on their own. That's something that they're going to be investing themselves. States are not involved in that directly. The zero-emission vehicle infrastructure that they can spend that on includes electric vehicles as well as hydrogen-powered fuel cell vehicles. We have taken it upon ourselves to have a couple of conversations with the folks at Volkswagen that are responsible for this portion of the settlement, and we wanted to make sure that they should not overlook the Midwest and Minnesota in particular as they're making these investments in infrastructure, because they're not required to spread this out in any particular way. The thing that we have learned is that they are interested in investments all across the country. They are focusing only on electric vehicles because Volkswagen has decided to stop making diesel vehicles altogether, and they're going all in on electric vehicles, so their intentions for this electric vehicle infrastructure is going to be, vehicle infrastructure is going to be all electric.
So, Mr. Thornton, when you had that conversation with whomever you said to not forget about, I'll say, the Midwest and Minnesota, what response did you get from them?
Mr. Chairman, they're interested. They want to start their investments in places where they think they're going to get early wins, and frankly that's going to be states that have already invested more currently in infrastructure for electric vehicles and have more electric vehicles on the road. But they're very interested in Minnesota. We're developing electric vehicle infrastructure plan that is what I would call funding ready, identifying places around the state where we need to have charging available if people are going to travel from here to Fargo or from here to Grand Marais and such. And we're going to be sharing that with them. They're also following the fact that Interstate 94 has been designated a zero-emission vehicle corridor by Federal Highway. And they're one of the things that they're interested in is trying to get some of their infrastructure installed along those zero-emission highway corridors in the country. So I think we're going to be okay there.
Thank you.
So then the final large bullet on this slide is that $2.9 billion is reserved for states, which includes Puerto Rico, tribes. And this is money that is to make up for the air pollution that has been coming from the engines that and vehicles that Volkswagen sold. It's mitigation. It's to mitigate the pollution problem that they have created through their actions. The amount of money that gets distributed to states is based on the number of affected vehicles registered in each jurisdiction. So each state gets a different amount of money. It just turns out that Minnesotans were not as enamored with Volkswagen diesel vehicles as some other states. So the per capita, we had less than, say, Maryland or other states of our size, similar size and population. So some states our size are going to be getting more money. Some states are going to get less. California, by virtue of their population and size, gets the most. I think their award here is about something like $300 million.
Before we go to the next slide, the Representative Metz has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I was just wondering if we have more details on the scrapping part of it. To me, it just seems kind of ridiculous that we take vehicles that work and not try to repair them.
Yeah,
Commissioner Thornton.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I don't, but we'll get some information for you on that.
Okay. Thank you.
Proceed, please.
So the way this works is that the federal court has set up a mitigation trust of $2.9 billion for states and tribes. The estimated amount of money that Minnesota is eligible to receive out of that trust is $47 million. You may have heard a different number in the news in the past. That was solely the two-liter vehicle number. They recently have settled on the three-liter vehicles in December, and so the amount of money that we're eligible for is a little more than the $43.6 million that people have been talking about. It's right at $47 million. The way this is going to operate is that the court will appoint a trustee to disperse the funds to states and tribes, which we have to apply for. And so dollars will flow directly from the trustee to the state, to the our tribe, and to the grantee. There are strict limits in the settlement as to how this money can be used. And again, to reiterate, the goal of this whole mitigation trust is to make up for the illegal excess pollution from Volkswagen engines that have already happened and continues to happen as long as they're on the roads.
Mr. Chairman, if I may,
yes.
Just one clarification. States and tribes also includes the District of Columbia and Puerto Rico.
Yep. Thank you. Question on the bullet point there on the strictly limiting the expenditures, and you have to apply for those. What are they allowing you then for, I'll say, administrative costs, and what are you projecting?
Mr. Chairman, for overhead for operating a program like this, they're allowing up to 15% of the state's amount, and we have not gotten into the details of trying to figure out what we're going to be suggesting for the state.
So, Commissioner Thornton, when you do get to that point, I think we'll have you back here to inform us as to how you're going to administer it and FTEs and all that sort of stuff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We'd be happy to.
Representative Hornstein has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to your point about the bullet points here and eligible projects, the last one says matching funds for projects eligible under the Diesel Emission Reduction Act. What would be an example or two of a project eligible under that statute?
Commissioner Thornton.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hornstein, the Diesel Emission Reduction Act is something that's been in place for a number of years, and we've been involved in getting grants from EPA for that. I'll just explain what is not included in the bullets above this that would be included in that, and that's essentially off-road construction equipment. The mitigation settlement did not allow for retrofitting or repowering off-road construction equipment, which actually we think is a flaw in the settlement, but they didn't ask us for our opinion. So it is possible, though, to do some emission reduction projects with off-road construction equipment through the matching fund with this DARA thing. And as far as the details of how that would work, we're not clear yet.
Thank you. And then, you know, while you're here, and I think you're one of our foremost experts on this, and this came up yesterday at a hearing on transit, but I wanted to get your perspective and how this mitigation money may potentially help us. But I know in the past our region has been in close to being a non-attainment area, and you know, my understanding is if we're in that category, then we have to pay fines and other things to the federal government. I understand we're not as close as we once were. Is that the case?
Commissioner Thornton.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hornstein, we're still relatively close to becoming a non-attainment area, but I'll go back to the first slide, or one of the earlier slides. You might recall I mentioned that the penalties are all about their excess emissions of nitrogen oxides, and that's not a pollutant that is of concern to us as diesel particulate. which is clearly a problem. It's a carcinogen or a potential carcinogen, and particulates exacerbate asthma and things like that. The beauty of this program, even though it's all focused on reducing nitrogen oxides, is that everything you do to reduce nitrogen oxides is also going to reduce diesel particulate for the most part. So there's a lot of multiple benefits that we're going to see from this program.
Follow up, Representative Hornstein.
Thank you.
Representative Wagenius.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You're welcome.
I've had a conversation with a utility that's interested in helping its communities buy electric school buses, not retrofitted buses, but actually manufactured buses. And so I want to ask a couple questions about that. Would they be eligible for some of the funds for, say, over the cost of a normal school bus? Would that be ineligible?
Commissioner Thornton.
Mr. Chairman, members, yes. We believe that either repowering or retrofitting or replacing an existing school bus or a transit bus, for that matter, with a cleaner burning engine, whether it's a natural gas engine or an electric engine, would be eligible for funding under this.
Representative Wagenius.
Now, was there some conversation in this court case about disadvantaged communities?
Commissioner Thornton.
Mr. Chairman, yes. The settlement asks states and tribes to address how their proposed use of the funds will affect disadvantaged communities. It does not lay out how that should be done, but it does say that we should consider that.
Representative Wagenius.
Well, thank you for that, Mr. Chair. So then there's the potential for putting electric school buses in quarters where we have more air pollution than in other quarters. And if that's the case, what concerns me is if several different communities want to apply for a grant or whatever, they don't have the power of being united and being able to purchase at a discount. Anytime you buy more than one, you're going to be able to strike a better bargain. Is that something you can coordinate, or does it have to be done by grant, or do you have some room there to be helpful to communities?
Commissioner Thornton.
Mr. Chairman, you know, I think that's a really good question, and it applies to other things in this category as well, because the more you're going to be purchasing, the lower the price that you're going to get. And so it does raise a bunch of questions as to how we might proceed in organizing some of this, and whether there might be some power in working collectively with some of our neighboring states, or maybe not necessarily neighboring states, but others, to, you know, increase the power of the money that we have. So that's one thing that we will be trying to look at.
Okay. Representative Torkelson, hopefully this isn't about a new combine.
Well, actually, it kind of is, because my question is, I see no mention whatsoever of agricultural equipment in many of these lists. As you know, we do use quite a bit of diesel power in agriculture, and I'm just curious as to why that's not being considered, or maybe I'm lucky it's not being considered. My new combine does have that DEF thing in it, so it smells real nice.
Commissioner.
Mr. Chairman, agricultural equipment is off-road. It would not qualify.
So is construction equipment.
And just like construction equipment, we have asked why and have not received a good answer. I don't know what to say.
Ms. Gauthier.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Representative Torkelson. So this is a private settlement of private funds from a private company, and so the court got to say whatever they wanted, and so they were very, very specific, and that's about all we can say. States don't have any ability to change that.
Representative Parkinson.
I've had a revelation, Mr. Chair. Volkswagen does not make combines.
True. And they wear their own shoes, too. Representative Neuberger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, as I track along here with you, I just have a question. Does the agency intend to use any of this funding to expand their enforcement of addressing these emissions in other areas, or is all of this going to go towards infrastructure and upgrades?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Neuberger, none of this money can be used for enforcement purposes. It all has to go to projects on this list.
Mr. Chairman, if I may, of it as a pass-through grant, Mr. Chairman and Representative Neuberger. This is just passing through to the court wants these vehicles off the road or retrofitted.
Follow up. Representative Hornstein.
Thanks. Mr. Chair. Is there a plan in terms of rolling this out in a more public way and involving the public? And I mean, I think there'll be a lot of different stakeholders. Do you have a plan for that?
Commissioner.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Representative, I'll get to that in a couple of slides if you'd like to wait.
Okay, sure.
So we've already talked about a number of the items on this list. This is it. This money can only be used on the items on this list. The only thing I want to highlight that we haven't already talked about is the second to last bullet, light duty zero emission vehicle supply equipment. The settlement specifically says up to 15% of the funds can be used for zero emission, vehicle infrastructure. And so we've had a lot of interest from parties about using some of this money for electric vehicle charging stations. So I just wanted to flag that for folks.
Chair Garofalo, I like that.
Yeah.
So the next slide, a little bit about how we believe this will work in the state. The settlement requires governors, or I suppose tribal chairs, to apply to be a beneficiary to receive their portion of the money on behalf of the state. The governor has to identify the state agency that will act as the primary fiscal agent, and the governor has indicated that would be the Pollution Control Agency. And the role of that fiscal agent would be to develop a mitigation trust plan that we submit to the trustee that has to be approved, eventually send out RFPs, requests for proposals for projects that would be eligible for the funding, and then to award and manage the grants. I think it's important to note that the trustee has to approve each emission reduction project. So they're going to be very carefully watching how this money is used. So we have little discretion within the state for that. Grantees can be local governments. They can be private companies. They can be nonprofits. And they can also be state and tribal governments. After consultation with Minnesota Management and Budget, it was decided that the appropriate way to accept these funds in the state is under the authority of 16A.013, which is titled Acceptance of Gifts. And that that section of statute specifically addresses funds coming from trusts. So this is not federal money. This is not state money. This is private money with a lot of strings attached. So that's how we plan to proceed. In terms of next steps, I already indicated that the state must apply to file as a beneficiary. We're preparing the paperwork for that right now. There is no trustee named yet. The court is interviewing candidates, as I understand it. It may be soon or it may be months before they select a trustee. Once the trustee is selected, the trustee will need to take some time to see whether there's some tweaks that need to be made in the process. And hopefully the trustee will provide states with a lot more detail about what needs to be in a mitigation plan and how to proceed, because we're operating sort of in the fog at the moment. We do plan extensive public participation. We have a website already. The link to that website is at the bottom of this next step slide. There's a lot of information on that website, and members of the public and others can use that website to comment already. And we've already received a number of comments from the public. They've all been about electric vehicles, I believe, so far. We intend a formal notice and comment period, as well as public meetings to get input. That will begin towards the end of February. We're expecting this process to take many months, and so we also are going to be forming a technical advisory committee, because there's a lot of technical aspects of this that need to be sorted out. Some of the ones that Representative Wagenius mentioned, for example, and we're going to need some smart people to help us work through this. And so we expect to have a technical advisory committee working to help us through the summer and then on beyond into the actual operations of the program. We also want to continue to engage with you, the legislature, during the session, and we need to figure out a good way to continue to engage with you after the session is over, because I expect most of the action on the initial filing with the trustee and the initial mitigation plan will probably happen sometime this summer or fall.
Thank you, Commissioner. Just one question on your second to the last slide. You said that the governor asked to apply, and you also said something about possibly tribal chairs. Can you elaborate on that for me a little bit, and then I have a follow-up.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I'm sorry I neglected to say that there is a separate pot of money in this mitigation trust for the tribes nationwide. It's about $54 million. And so they have the ability to apply to the trustee on their own, each individual tribe, for some portion of that money. We have been talking to our tribes in Minnesota and encouraging them to take that path, and we've been offering any help that they want to help them do that, and we hope that they do so.
So then is it your understanding that when those grants are given out to a state and a tribe, that they would be two separate entities? I mean, would MPCA be involved in implementing and planning and deciding on how the tribe would spend those dollars?
Mr. Chairman, not directly. If they want our help, we'd be happy to give them some advice, but no, it would be their, it would be the same, two separate pots of money.
Thank you. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I think this case is important because it shows the power of enforcement, shows the power of agencies when you have a crooked company who purposefully alters equipment to dodge the law. It's hard. I don't think this is a case that could have been worked out over a cup of coffee talking about it or with cost share or voluntary compliance. There are crooked companies, not all of them, maybe only a few of them, but this is a big deal, huge deal. And Mr. Chair, is there still other litigation going on with Volkswagen separate from this case?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hansen, the Attorney General and other Attorneys General have sued Volkswagen for violating state anti-tampering regulations. Not all states have such a regulation. I don't remember the states that are a part of that lawsuit, and that is currently pending.
And Mr. Chair, maybe this is a question for MMB rather than you, but does the state of Minnesota purchase any Volkswagen vehicles or equipment or motors?
Commissioner, Ms. Gauthier.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Actually, that would be a question for the Department of Administration, and we don't have somebody here from admin today, but I can get that information for you, unless you know.
No, I was just going to say, sorry, Mr. Chairman, I was just going to say that I haven't seen any Volkswagen vehicles in the fleet, but I couldn't say for sure.
Jeff Hansen.
Mr. Chair, I think we buy American, but just in case, I mean, I think there's, we talked earlier about, you know, if enforcement and regulations don't work or they're off the table, we don't have to buy their stuff, you know, so I think it'd be helpful to find out, you know, if we're buying Volkswagen's stuff.
Thank you. Representative Becker Finn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So for better or worse, I am a lawyer. So when I see that the court has set up a trustee, right away to me that says, you know, there's some additional fiduciary responsibilities that trustee is going to have. And so you know, that kind of says to me that the court's intent is that this money be spent really carefully. So I just wanted to kind of clarify it on this slide. So we're in the process of applying to be a beneficiary, and once you apply, each individual project would have to meet these very specific bullets. And are there any additional things outside of these bullets on this handout?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chairman, members, the only thing is the state overhead cost for operating the effort.
Ms. Gauthier.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Representative Becker-Finn. You're right about the trustee. Every state or tribe or District of Columbia or Puerto Rico has to do a plan, and the trustee can say, I like this, I don't like that, I want this, the trustee has to approve that and all the expenditures in it before we can do anything. So, yeah, it's a situation where the trustee has, it's very much private money going for private grants to do specific things. It's very tied up.
Paula?
No, thanks.
Thank you. Representative Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Thornton or Ms. Gauthier, whichever one. I just want to clarify because in listening, did you say that 15% would be for administration? Did I hear that right?
Commissioner.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, up to 15%.
Mr. Chair, so you're not really clear on that yet, but then 15% would be for the zero emission?
Up to 15% can go towards zero emission infrastructure. So these are things that we still need to work out and get some input from the public and other experts.
Ms. Gauthier.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Representative Green. So the up to 15% for administrative, we're anticipating that we will, well, we know we're going to have a lot of grants that we'll be making with this money. I mean, almost all of the money will be grants. So grant administration and management, making sure that the grantees report back, because we'll have to account to the trustee for how the money was spent. Things like that are the administrative 15%, and then the electric vehicle percent, 15% is one of the things on the list that we can spend the money on, too. We just don't know yet the details about what our administrative costs will look like.
Representative Green.
Well, thank you for clarifying that. I guess and when I was looking through all the, for lack of a better term, the hoops you're going to have to jump through just to administer the money, it looks like probably the 15% will be used up pretty fast. Now, when you're going around the state and doing the for the public participation, is that coming out of this fund as well?
Commissioner. Ms. Gauthier.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Green. The costs for us to hold listening sessions and community input sessions and so forth around the state, which you're right, we really want to do that would be part of our administrative cost of getting this money out to the grantees for the specific purposes that it can be spent on.
Representative Green.
And then the other question is, the tribes have their own pool of money that they can draw from. Will they also have access to the $47 million from Minnesota then?
Ms. Gauthier, Commissioner.
Actually, I think that they could be applicants for some of that money. I think a consideration would be whether or not they availed themselves of the special pool of tribal money. So that's something that we'll be looking at.
Excuse me, Representative Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess the point I'm trying to get across is I'm not going to say that one of those is bad or not, or the administration costs are out of line. I'm just saying that, you know, we're going to start looking at projects here, and if things go the way they always do around here, we're going to have probably $450 million worth of requests, and this money is going to be gone in very short order. So I think it would really be good for this committee and other committees to keep a close watch on this, because otherwise it could be gone before we know it and we may not get what we're really looking for. So,
thank you, Representative Green. Ms. Gauthier.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. So the way this is set up, because these are private funds going through a trustee to make up for past pollution, it's not going to be something that would run as a bill in front of the legislature. It's going to be a separate process because the court set it up that way. So it's going to be something that is going to be treated as a gift, like Assistant Commissioner Thornton said, because it's private money coming into the state technically as a gift from a trustee. So it wouldn't be any different than if the Bill Gates Foundation gave us money through their foundation to do a specific thing in Minnesota. So there's all kinds of laws, federal and state, that when you receive a gift with strings attached that you have to follow all those strings. And so we've got those plus the court. So it's not going to be it isn't something that the court set up to come through the traditional appropriation process of like a tribe or a territory or Puerto Rico or a state. If that helps, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I do understand that, and I wasn't suggesting that we put legislative approval on this, but I was saying that we should watch it and closely, and make our recommendations. So yeah, I understand that. Thanks.
And Representative Green, to that point, that's part of the reason why we have this hearing today is because I do think that we, as elected officials and representing our constituents, that we should have some input into this. Commissioner.
Yeah, and Mr. Chairman, that goes to the point I made earlier that we need to continue to be engaged during session, but we need to figure out a good way to keep engaged off session, because that's when a lot of this will probably happen.
Thank you. Representative Clark, we got to move on here, folks, too. So.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to double check. I think there's several other car companies, manufacturers that have recently appeared in the news with some of the same issues, right? And I'm just wondering, is that something you can anticipate any costs for or been thinking about, and what your information is on that?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Clark, if you're referring to the fact that there's been some allegations that Fiat Chrysler has been involved in similar activities, I don't know anything about that, and we'll just have to watch whatever potential enforcement action EPA might be taking.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's unfortunate. I just been hearing that, and it seems like it's, you know, our American car companies are having some of the same issues. So, unfortunately, I said unfortunately, it appears that some of our American car companies are having some of the same issues.
Thank you. Representative Beckerfin.
Real quick, just wanted to clarify that the trustee. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You're welcome.
The trustee would also have to approve that the administrative costs, whatever they are reasonable as well.
Commissioner.
Mr. Chairman, that's exactly correct. We'll have to document and verify that those are legitimate costs.
Thank you.
Thank you for being here today. We appreciate that.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Next up, Dave Irons and Luke Skinner.
Okay,
Gentlemen, thank you for being here. Would you please identify yourselves for the record and proceed?
I'm Dave Wirens. I'm Assistant Director with the Board of Water and Soil Resources.
Good morning. Luke Skinner, Director of the Division of Ecological and Water Resources for the DNR.
Thank you. Proceed.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, we'd like to go over the Section 404 Assumption Study Report and give you some highlights and some of the findings from the report. I'm going to spend a little bit of time just setting the stage for the report about 404 Assumption, and then I'm going to turn it over to Mr. Wirens to talk about the study and the results and the findings from that. So. First, it's just important to understand the regulatory framework within the state of Minnesota. So any work that wants to occur in wetlands or water bodies of the state are overseen by three different regulatory functions. One is federal, and that's the Federal Clean Water Act, Section 404, and that is implemented by the Corps of Engineers. And then there's two state ones. One is the Wetland Conservation Act, which is overseen by Bowser and then working with local units of government for implementation. And the third is the Public Waters Permits Program through the DNR for public waters in the state. So all three of these combined are the ones that oversee wetland and water regulation in the state. So when we refer to Section 404 Assumption, we're talking about the state assuming the responsibility for the water and wetland permitting aspects of the Federal Clean Water Act, Section 404. That's just the basic concept, and we'll talk about that more as we go on. So what does this mean? So if you look at a wetland out there, there's some overlapping jurisdictions on many of the wetlands in the state. In the graphic you have here, you have a wetland that is both a public water, has some WACO requirements, but also could be covered by the Section 404 by the way they're delineated across the state. So in some cases, you will need two permits in the state, both a federal and a state permit, to do work. So if a project proposer wants to run something through and it hits both these areas, then they would need a permit for that purpose. And this just gives you an example of one that has both jurisdictions, both federal and state jurisdiction. And this is to show you, this is a map from Aiken County, from a section of wetlands. The light blue, as you can see, are public waters that are regulated by the state, DNR, and the rest of the other colors are all WACA wetlands of different varieties that would have to go through the WACA process. All of these, or some of these, could also be federally regulated if they're connected, navigable waters, etc. So there's some overlapping jurisdiction. So it just shows you the kind of the complexity of some of the work that we have to do when we work through these issues across the state. So what are the challenges? Why are we thinking about this feasibility study and why assume 404? So one of the issues is permit time. If you look at this, just give you an example, just for the Section 404 for the federal permits, give you an example. Over the last 5 years, there have been nearly 8,000 permit requests to the Corps of Engineers. The vast majority of those, about 5,000 of those, go through their general permit functions and I have an average about 60 days to get to an issuance or a denial for a permit. But there's still there's a section here you can see, both the what we call letters of permission issued or individual permits that take significantly a lot more time. This is a real burden on those that are trying to do the work in the field. You know, the concerns for these permits that fall outside this general permit of 60 days. You can see some of them average 149 days to get to permit decision, and the others almost 10 months at 312 days. So that's a lot of time, costs, and impacts to our constituents out there that are working on this. So this is one of the main drivers, and also this idea of that we have to have two permits, one from the state and federal in many of these cases in the state. So these are the things that kind of drove the study. So back in 2015, and Representative Fabian was one of the key authors of this legislation, directed the Department of Natural Resources and Bowser to jointly look and study the feasibility of the state assuming the administration of the Section 404 permit program of the Clean Water Act. First of all, what does this mean? You know, the specific provisions in the Section 404 of the Clean Water Act allows the state to implement their own regulatory programs instead of having the Corps of Engineers issue Section 404 permits in their state, except for waters or wetlands, which must be remained under the Corps' authority, and which we'll get into that a little bit later. When the state assumes a Section 404, it's important to know that we're not taking it over from the Corps. What we are doing is we're implementing our own state regulatory program or programs in the state to do that, and which these have to be approved by the Environmental Protection Agency to meet these Section 404 permit requirements. So under Section 404 assumption, there is still federal oversight. The EPA has the opportunity to review state permits and conduct programmatic reviews. So just kind of setting the backdrop as we start to think about playing this in. So with that, I'd like to turn it over to Mr. Wyrens to talk about the process that we went through through the study and some of the findings.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Skinner, and members of the committee. First off, it's important to understand, what are the goals of the study? The legislation that directed the board and DNR to undertake this effort did include 11 specific elements we were required to address as part of that. But fundamentally, it's boiled down to the question seen on the screen in front of you. What would it take and what would need to change for the state to assume 404? That's the question we had to, in fact, answer. And the approach that we were taking in developing this is to have an objective, fact-based approach, trying to identify the work to be required to be done and what the implication that would, in fact, be. The requirement did not have us actually include recommendations, if just to address the 11 elements. But however, as a separate element, the agencies did, in fact, decide to generate some recommendations. We felt it important that would ask the question, okay, we have this set of facts in this 103-page document. Now what happens next? And we did, in fact, come to some recommendation on what we think the next steps are. And we'll be discussing those later on in this presentation as well.
And members, just so you, if you followed your emails, there's a link to the complete study that Mr. Iron just mentioned on our committee page as well. Okay, so if you want all, did you say 149 pages or
130 pages?
130 pages. It's there. It makes for some great reading. Proceed, please.
Mr. Chair, it does speak to the complexity of what assumption is all about and the various factors that need to be considered as part of taking a closer look at that. But in terms of the process that we, in fact, developed, the authorizing legislation, we only spoke to DNR and Bowser doing this study. However, we invited the Pollution Control Agency to participate as well. They have responsibilities in wetland and water quality standards and as well as doing 401 reviews under the Section 404 program, and we felt it appropriate and really important to include them in the process as well. We invited and developed a core study stakeholder group, a diverse a group of 16 organizations. We asked to be kind of at the table to assist us in this particular process. But in addition, we also had a much larger group of folks that we communicated with, 39 different organizations. In fact, the contact list includes over 100 different individuals that we've been communicating with on a regular basis during the course of this particular work. We also have engaged the agencies, both the Corps of Engineers, the EPA, Fish and Wildlife Service in this effort as well, as they all have a role to play in how the Clean Water Act program operates. And we've also had several conversations with Minnesota tribes as well, as their authority is distinct under federal law, and they need to be recognized as part of this process as well. And in fact, the project staff are meeting with the tribes even next month to kind of go over the results of this study as well. And, of course, we have engaged the leadership of the agencies, both the Executive Director Bowser and the DNR and PCA Commissioner's Office in this process as well. So in terms of stakeholder involvement, the authorizing legislation required us to involve stakeholders in the development of the plan of study. We had four meetings of the core study group. As indicated, there are 16 organizations on the core study group. But at this point, recognize we had between 30 and 50 folks in attendance at every single one of the meetings. We had a lot of interest, a lot of participation in the work that we're in fact doing. We would share the information and report drafts. There were frequent communications going out especially as chapters, draft chapters being developed of this, to really give the interested folks as much time as possible and as early possible knowledge of what are you coming up with and a chance to give us feedback as we are, in fact, developing that. And all the information has been posted on the Bowser website for public availability. Anybody go there, see what's been going on in the course of the study, and see the various drafts as well as the final products as well. It's important to understand what the role of the stakeholders is. It's to ensure a proper scope of study. We felt it important that as we're developing this, that they kind of help us figure that out, because at the end of the day, what we're working on is going to have some impact on them, and they can help make it a better, more complete work, which is important. Provide feedback on a wide range of viewpoints and to remain informed of the study findings. Now, in terms of the report and in the executive summary that you did in fact receive as part of the meeting today, there were four key findings that the report did in fact result in. I'll discuss each of those in turn as part of this presentation. The first one deals with permitting. And you see on the slide on the screen, there really are three main points that that we think are relevant here in terms of our analysis of what might be different under a assumed program than what is currently in fact the case. We believe that for some permits, particularly the individual permits and letters of permission, as referred to Mr. Skinner, we believe that state permitting would in fact result in a faster timeline for those category of current 404 approvals. Based upon the existing framework under Minnesota state law that results in approvals on a 60-day time frame, we believe that we could do them faster in those circumstances. And we think there would also be improved permitting efficiency and cost savings for permittees. Again, as Mr. Skinner referred to, there are going to be many cases where applicants are required to get both a state and a federal approval. Under an assumed program, that would be down to one. There would be great efficiency. There would be cost savings in the permitting process that applicants would, in fact, receive under a assumed program.
And to that point, there, in the report where you say cost savings to the permittees, one of the concerns that I have and it's been expressed to me is that there's no report or there's no information that relates back to the cost savings to the LGUs who are trying to do this. And I remember one of the meetings, St. Louis County, I think, said that just on a couple of permits that they had, they could have expedited them and saved $500,000. So we'll be asking some questions about that, too.
Hi, Mr. Chair. Would you like me to address that now or
sure.
Wait until...
Go ahead.
Well, I think what I, to the question of the financial cost savings, which, of course, is I think really at the root of the purpose of the study are delays experienced by some applicants and thereby the resulting cost increases that they've experienced. I think the report does in fact address that topic, perhaps not as much detail as some would like, where we do make the statement in the report that it's highly likely that applicants that receive again a letter of permission or an interim permit would achieve some cost savings. However, there are several challenges actually giving a number to quantify what that in fact is. The first one is how do you identify what a inflationary factor is? The report speaks to three different methodologies used routinely by the construction industry, and they're all differing amounts of inflationary factors. How do we pick which one to apply a factor to? And the other part, too, is that it's very difficult to identify a project that is delayed, goes beyond what the applicant would prefer. What are the, in fact, causes for that? Kind of why did that, in fact, happen? And was there necessarily increased costs in every case a project goes to 200 or 300 days, as the case might be? We think the only way really to get to numbers that are justifiable and defensible is to go through a more detailed study to evaluate, you know, a sample of individual projects to identify what happened and what the cost changes were, and to come to a result at that point.
Proceed, please.
The second key find deals with the Sumba Waters. This is a critical issue, certainly our belief in the results of the study, and this will come again at the tail end of this when we talk about next steps as well. But what the challenges here that we see is that there are certain waters that are required to remain under federal jurisdiction. There is no authority under the Clean Water Act to transfer those to state authority. But there are some that, in fact, the Corps of Engineers can transfer, can be assumed by the state. The challenge we've experienced that there currently is a lack of clear federal guidance on which waters could be assumed under state authority and which would remain under, let me phrase that. There are some waters that would clearly be retained under federal authority, but it's not really clear which ones could be assumed under state authority. It's the current guidance on the federal level is really not as clear as we would like, in fact, to be. In fact, we've been engaging with the Corps of Engineers to get a very clear statement from them, a letter from the St. Paul District, so we can very clearly understand how do they determine or view waters that are assumable under the Clean Water Act. And as it turns out, we did just get that letter yesterday morning, and we've not yet had opportunity to fully evaluate that particular letter. But again, we'll speak more to how this plays into the next steps later on in this presentation.
And you got that letter yesterday, you said?
Yesterday morning, okay. Mr.
So
Chair.
You forward copies of that to the committee?
We certainly can do that.
Thank you. Representative Torkelson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Wyrens, can you tell me how many other states have assumed 404?
Mr. Wyrens. Mr. Chair, there are two states that have assumed the program, New Jersey and Michigan. They both undertook that action back in the 1980s.
Thank you.
Representative Torkelson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And can you tell me how the feds handled the guidance with those two states as far as the delineation of assumable waters?
Director Wyrens.
Well, it's my understanding. I will start the answer. Actually, the project manager can step up and correct me if I overspeak here. But it's my understanding that they assumed the program really in a different era. There were a number of Supreme Court decisions and following Corps and EPA guidance that came along afterwards that really have kind of changed the landscape. And so it's my understanding that that they're operating under those type of circumstances, and they've not been directly applied under the guidance that we're developing right now. And I've advised that if they were to approach the Corps and EPA today for assumption, the answer they would receive would be very different than what they received back in the 1980s.
Representative Torkelson.
That's our expectation, at least.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Have any changes been made to the delineation of waters in those two states as a result of the actions you're describing?
Mr. Irons.
Mr. Chair, the answer is no, not to our knowledge.
Representative Torkelson.
I'm done.
Representative Eklund.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, but Representative Torkelson beat me to the punch on that question, so we're good.
Thank you. And, you know, I would just suggest to the committee that, you know, there are some changes coming out of Washington, maybe even as we speak, that could be beneficial to us. Thank you. Continue.
All right. The third key finding addresses implementation. One of the very first conversations we had with the EPA when we gained this effort is to have the conversation about the current structure of weather regulation in the state of Minnesota. The public water program is administered by a state agency, by DNR, but the Weather Conservation Act, in fact, is not. The decisions are made by local governments, by counties, some of our conservation districts, watershed districts, cities, and townships make those decisions. The board does not. We support and are part of the process, but these are local government decisions under the law. And one of the very first things we are informed is that the Clean Water Act is really, EPA and their attorneys have told us, there really is not much room for debate. It must be a state decision under an assumed program. And what that means is the least disruptive option that occurred to us is that, at least under the Conservation Act portion of this, that it become a Bowser decision, would have to be transferred to the Bowser for us to make the decision as a state entity under assumed program. Now, we also believe that and think there's a lot of value to be maintained by trying to maximize the existing local government expertise that's been developed over time. Certainly, from our experience in running this program for 25, 26 years now, is that there's been a great deal of local government expertise and developed in wetland regulation, and it'd be our goal, if assumption was forward, is to retain as much of that as possible to maintain that particular effort. But certainly, as we've been advised, is that any application for assumption would, in fact, require there to be, you know, state decision-making under the wetland conservation, which, again, is not the case currently. And the last of the four findings addresses costs. And we think it's important to try and estimate what would the cost of assumption effect be. And as you see the slide here is we are and went through a very detailed process to estimate what those cost savings would in fact be. We believe that the state government would incur increased costs of between $3.5 and $4.8 million annually. There'd be a resulting requirement of additional staff at the state level, principally at the Border Water and Soil Resources, of depending upon the scenario of 23 to 53 full-time equivalents. And the two scenarios that we evaluated is the first one is where there'd be we maintain a very strong local government role. That'd be the lower increased staffing where local governments still maintain a strong role in the process. Where there is no local role in wetland regulation and approval, where it's all being done through the state, that would result in a higher FTE level as we have tried to estimate here as well. We also believe that, depending upon the scenario, there'd be a savings on the part of local governments. Under any assumed scenario, again, based on what we know today, our expectation local governments would have less work to do than is currently the case. And therefore, there should be some cost savings associated with that. And moving on to next steps, Mr. Chair, this PowerPoint has not been updated since yesterday morning, as you see here, because we did, in fact, receive that letter yesterday morning from the St. Paul District. But certainly our intention is to analyze that particular letter and go through a GIS analysis to really estimate, based upon that, what and how many waters would be assumed under the current core position on what waters could be transferred to authority. We certainly will be sharing that with the stakeholders and make that available on our website as well as that is developed. But I think it's critical to have that particular information available to understand what the true benefits are. The more waters that are suitable, the more benefits can be achieved because there will be less dual permitting going on. That's kind of the train of thought that goes into this. And following that is then to working with the agency leadership, both DNR, Bowser, and PCA, is to make a determination if and how to pursue 404 assumption. Mr. Chair, with that, I thank you for the opportunity to present the report this morning. I'd be happy to answer further questions that the committee may have.
My plan is just to bring down Mr. Owney right now, and you guys can have a seat someplace and hopefully get to some questions later. But I want to make sure that people who are here want to testify have ample time to get their testimony in. I recognize, as Lon's coming down here, that this is an ongoing process. And even if we voted today and the governor signed it tomorrow to do the assumption, it would still require us to work with EPA to get to that point, and that could be a lengthy period as well. I am interested in making sure that this process continues to move forward. Representative Green, did you have a question right now?
If you want to testify, just go back and wait.
I'd like to do that. Thank you. Members, one of the main reasons why I got started in this effort to study the feasibility of assuming the 404 permitting is because of a gentleman like Lon Owney. Lon is a Marshall County engineer. The engineers in my part of the state have expressed a great deal of frustration with the process in terms of time and money and duplication, and we're trying to streamline things in this process. So, Lon, thank you for all the input that you've had in educating me. I know as much about 404 permitting as hogs do about Sunday school when this process started, and I only know just a little bit more. But that being said, thank you for the work that you've done. And Mr. Norris, if I happen to forget, I'm going to say it now, thank you for the work that you put into this. You were in a tough spot, so I recognize that. Mr. Owney, identify yourself for the record and who you represent, and proceed with your testimony.
All right, thank you. First of all, thank you, committee, for allowing me to be here. My name is Lon Owney. I'm the Marshall County engineer, and I've been serving on this core group for this task since it started. One of the main things I'd like to do first is also thank Mr. Norris for his efforts. If you can imagine the wide array of opinions and thoughts that were in the room, and for him to condense that down and be able to compile that into a 130-page document, is without saying too much, it's a major undertaking, and I think he needs to be thanked very much for that. first thing we did when we first met, the first meeting we had, one of the questions was, is what do we want to see as an outcome from this this study? And my response to that was to see a more streamlined process and to see a process that would be more beneficial to the local effort for the local people, but also still meet the requirements of the wetland conservation and all the permitting requirements to protect our environment. Last week you received a letter from both Minnesota County Engineers Association, AMC, and MICA, stating some thoughts that we had related to the report.
And members, it's in your packet today as well.
What we've come down to is the conclusion that, you know, that you, the Mr. Wirens, did a very good job of outlining the report, outlining the concerns that we saw and what we felt were issues that we had to address. I guess it's our opinion as a group, AMC, MCEA, and MICA, that we maybe need to look at this a little bit further to better evaluate some of the items that are out there. Due to the short time frame of trying to get something like this accomplished, we felt it wasn't possible to really outline the costs of the savings for the local units. In Marshall County's particular situation, we would probably were seeing maybe somewhere between a 5% and 10% increase in cost to our project due to delays. Now, that's not blaming that on the Board of Water and Soil Resources. That's not blaming it on DNR. It's blaming it on the process that we had to go through for permitting. And we, in the last 10 years, we've done projects that have required permitting every year, and we've probably had two projects that have proceeded in a timely manner that we would be comfortable with, and that being that 3 to 6 month time frame. Everything else has been delayed longer than that, you know, to pushing us into a minimum of the next construction season. The other thing that we thought needed to be looked at a little bit further is the number of employees that are needed to evaluate such a program. We feel that there's very good programs in the state of Minnesota right now that would be great models to be followed, and we'd like to maybe see that further evaluated and maybe outlined a little bit more. The other thing that we talked about, and I believe it's pointed out in the letter as well, is the electronic permitting. There's mention of that in the report, that there's an additional $3 million cost to implement the permitting process plus a number of full-time employees. It's our opinion that has been talked about before this feasibility study, and is probably something that's going to be moving ahead anyway, and therefore probably should not be included so much as it can be brought up as a discussion item, but maybe not included in the decision making of the overall report. I guess in summary, it's more or less a situation where we felt that there really wasn't enough time to put together the report and thoroughly outline and define whether going ahead with 404 assumption is the right thing to do or not. And it's our opinion that we need to look at this a little bit further, maybe get a little more specific on some of the items that we want to look at, and then evaluate those to help us make a better decision as to whether or not we can assume this program or not. If there's any questions, I'd be happy to try and answer those.
Mr. Downey, I think we're going to wait on those unless, because I want to bring down Mr. Harnack, and if both of you want to stay at the table, you can certainly do that. I know you've worked together in the past. You... Mr. Harnack, would you please identify yourself for the record and who you represent?
Yes, Mr. Chairman and members, my name is Ron Harnack, and I'm representing the watershed districts who have participated on the core group here, and also the Red River Watershed Management Board. I appreciate the opportunity to bring some thoughts to you this morning on the 404 assumption report. I want to also commend Doug Norris in particular. I thank the challenges he had before him with the mix of folks that we were dealing with, and trying to maintain an unbiased perspective as we went forward. I think he's done a very good job. I think the report does provide a good basis of assessing where we're at today, but it does not tell us whether we should move forward with assumption or not. There's more work that needs to be done with it. The real purpose for going through this was to try to create greater regulatory efficiency, to reduce regulatory duplication and redundancy, really trying to get one permit rather than two or three, to provide greater regulatory certainty. When you're dealing with two regulatory agencies and sometimes three, it's really difficult for the regulated public to really have an idea of where are we going and how are we going to get there with any degree of certainty. It was also to provide some uniformity and consistency in wetland regulation, rather than in some instances to meet two sets of standards that have the basic framework that is the same, to not have a net loss of wetlands. And how do we get there? In some cases, it takes two or three different approaches in order to get to that answer, and we should be all on the same page. And the other is to ensure that there is no less protection of wetlands, and in some cases, I think, you can achieve a greater protection of wetlands. Again, I think the report provides some good background to move forward with. There are some elements, and some of them will be repeated of what Lon indicated. We believe there needs to be greater assessment of the staffing needs associated with assumption. We think that local units of government can play a much larger role than what is suggested here. I understand in talking with the folks from Michigan that it's very clear that EPA requires that a state agency has to make the final decision. How you get to that final decision has a lot of flexibility. And if a lot of that can be taken through the local units of government, like they do today with WACA, I think we can have significant improvements in what the staffing requirements are in this. I think the report also does a poor job, and I think timing was an issue there, of reflecting what the cost benefits are to the regulated public. Lon suggested what it might be for some county projects. I can speak for very specifically about two flood control projects, water retention project, comprehensive water management projects in the Red River Valley. And it took an additional 2 to 3 years to get the 404 permit processed. In the end, the permit that was issued by WACA and the permit that was ultimately issued by the Corps had virtually no difference other than delay, which cost our projects somewhere approaching $1 million as a result of that delay. Now, we recognize that it's very difficult to put all projects into one categorization, but some work that was done by the consultant that was supported some of these evaluations was suggesting that maybe the cost was somewhere between 1 and 5% increase associated with delay. I don't think you can do that just generically, because you can have a $500,000 project and an 18-month to 2-year delay can almost double the cost. You can have a $30 million project and the outgrowth of that may be a very small percent of increase, but the dollar amount is still significant in the end anyway. So, Mr. Chairman, we think that this approach that has been taken allows us to move forward with the next step. There needs to be an appropriation to Bowser and DNR to move forward with negotiating with EPA and with the Corps of Engineers on what will it take for us to make that final decision on assumption. Bring something back to the legislature in FY or January of 2019, I think would be a fair approach to consider. And tell us, what do we have to do to change our WACA laws? What do we have to do to change our public waters laws in order to move forward with one permitting process that deals with wetlands in the state of Minnesota? So we hope that you can give that kind of context some serious consideration as we move forward here. I believe the governor has suggested there is some money in his appropriation. If I've got my numbers right, can be clarified, but it's like about $60,000 a year that is advocated for the 404 assumption continuation. We certainly do not feel, if you're going to do an adequate job of negotiation with the Corps and EPA and with the Corps stakeholders, that is not sufficient to be able to make the process work effectively and efficiently. So, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I'll try to answer any questions that you might have.
Thank you, Mr. Harnack. Is there anybody else that wishes to testify at all on this? Okay, then we'll proceed with some questions. Representative Green, you're first.
Thank you. My questions are probably more for the previous gentleman. Looking through just some of the statements that you made, and you talked about the how the state sets the rules, and yet in the report on page 9, it talked about Minnesota Statute 103G.127. I haven't read that statute, but apparently what it says is that for us to do this assumption, we would have to change our laws and to allow for more rulemaking and more restrictive laws in Minnesota for this to go through. Is that correct?
Mr. Wirens.
Mr. Chair and Representative Green, as was outlined in the presentation, is that the assumption process would have the state of Minnesota have to make adjustments to our regulatory programs, public waters, and the Wetland Conservation Act, that in turn then could be certified by the EPA as meeting 404 standards. That would require, again, the state laws to be essentially equivalent in their regulatory standards and their outcomes as the Clean Water Act 404 program currently is.
Representative Green.
So what you're saying is just what it says here. We have to have more restrictive laws in Minnesota to make this work. You've indicated that right now we have dual permitting, so we have state permitting and federal permitting. Why is it that you need between 23 and 53 new FTEs and millions more when you're already apparently doing a lot of this permitting? We're just eliminating the federal government.
Director Wirens.
Mr. Chair and Representative Green, to your prior point, the issue being more restrictive or not is that there are certainly some elements of state law that are more restrictive than the federal, and the reverse is true as well. It'd be making sure that the program meets at a minimum the standards of the Clean Water Act 404 program. Regarding your second question, is that there are current responsibilities that state agency staff do not currently do because they're delegated through state law, through the Wetland Conservation Act, to local governments. As one of the scenarios laid out here, to the extent there are additional duties that are required on the part of agencies, we would need additional staff to meet those requirements as well. And we try to do our best to estimate those and went through a number of revisions to try and get those as accurate as we could based upon what we in fact know today, is to keep that. You know, the idea was not to build a huge bureaucracy, but what I think is truly needed to get the job done as it currently is.
Representative Green.
Mr. Chair, you know, I've been through this with other agencies as well, where every time you flip a page, they need a new FTE. And if you take away some of the responsibilities of the agencies, they never get rid of FTEs. They always need them. And so I don't see where the workload is going to increase that much. But also on page 9, apparently in 2015, Congressman Gibbs put some recommendations forward. One was to remove the barriers to 404 assumption, and the other was to allow for formal recognition of state programs, allow for partial assumption, and provide federal funding for the implementation. Are you aware of any talks on a federal level, if you keep track of that, if these move forward, and if they do, how will that affect the decisions in Minnesota?
And Representative Green, to that point, I have talked to some of our congressional delegation, and I am encouraging that those things continue moving, but Director Wirens.
Well, and Mr. Chair and Representative Green, obviously if the changes outlined in page 9 were to occur, we would need to reevaluate the current evaluation, because we looked at what's required to assume the program as it is today, and these would be very significant changes that require reevaluation of some of the factors we took a look at.
Representative Green.
I have one more question.
Yes, sir.
Unless something spurs me on here, but you also mentioned that you had to reevaluate the waters that we have. I forget the exact statement that you made, but to look at the areas that need permitting and reassess them. And it looks to me, from every map that I've seen, you've got maps of every pothole from Canada to Iowa. How much money is it going to take to go in now, and why do you have to reevaluate when all you have to do is look at the permit applications that come in?
Director Wyring.
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Green, I guess I don't know to what you were referring, but perhaps it's to this analysis of the Corps of Engineers' position on assumable waters that we believe we need to take a look at. How would that position work in terms of identifying which waters could be assumed, which could, in fact, not be assumed? We, in fact, are intending to do that evaluation with existing resources to come to that evaluation. They indicate we're going to share that with stakeholders so they're kind of aware of how we are interpreting that correspondence from the Corps of Engineers, what it means on the ground, and we intend to actually get concurrence on that from the Corps to the extent we can, so that when you come out with what that statewide map looks like of which waters are assumed, which are not, it's something that the Corps will stand behind. So it's not just our estimation, but it's also agreed to by the Corps, by the Corps of Engineers as well.
Representative Green.
Well, just another comment, Mr. Chair. I'm not going to look it up, but when we were going through the report, it appears that even with the savings to the county, the increases to the state are greater. I really think we need to get more in touch on the federal level and get this straightened out, because increased cost to the state and as many as 53 FTEs that we'll be paying for now for years to come with all the benefits is something that is going to be hard to swallow.
Thank you. And is there anyone here from Army Corps? I don't think there is. One of the things that I would ask maybe for your work group to find out is how many FTEs does Army Corps designate to here comes the phone a friend, I think. How many FTEs does Army Corps dedicate to 404 assumption in Minnesota? Identify yourself for the record, Mr. Norris, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Doug Norris. I'm the Wetlands Program Coordinator for the DNR Division of Ecological and Water Resources. The report addresses the number of Corps employees, and there are between 49 and 53 that the Corps employees in Minnesota to handle their current permitting processes, depending on their level of staffing and vacancies.
Specifically for 404 or all of their other work that they are doing as well?
I believe it's for Section 404 and Section 10 permitting, which is Section 10 of the Rivers and Harbors Act.
Okay, thank you. Representative Lewick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Question on what interface or consultation, if any, took place with the Public Utilities Commission and the Department of Commerce relative to permitting pipelines. Obviously, there's another series of permits and permissions before you can get to a 404. Were they part of this look? Because some parts of Minnesota, that's a huge deal.
Mr. Norris.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, we did not consult with them on this. That was not something that was on our radar.
Representative Lewick.
I would just suggest that that's another piece of work left undone. Second question, when we talked about costs, did we make any attempt to identify projects not started, abandoned, or couldn't be done? Specifically relative to time delays. We do know that one way to move an investor away and out of Minnesota is simply delay long enough that the bankers pick up the money and go find a better place to invest their infrastructure dollars.
Mr. Norris.
So did we look at that? Is that part of the examination?
Mr. Norris.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, no, I don't believe we looked at any situations like that.
I would address some of the previous comments. We did include the St. Louis County study that was referred to, the $500,000 savings. That is cited in our report. But in terms of what you're asking about specifically, projects that were never undertaken, we did not look at those.
Representative Wagenius.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Barnes, one of the testifiers talked about electronic processing of permits and that we would need some extra money for that. And that surprised me. I would have assumed that everything in this day and age would be electronic. So help me understand what's going on here.
Mr. Norris or Wyrons?
No, actually, I should respond to that, not Mr. Chair. In reference to Guineas, the current system we operate under for the wetland conservation permitting, there is a form that is available online that applicants can use to get the process started. But when it comes to actually applying for a wetland conservation permit, you have to go to the individual local union government and go through their permitting process. So there is no statewide online permitting portal that in fact exists. Certainly that's something we have been having conversations about, and as Mr. Harkin referred to, one item that is in the governor's budget is some funding to do some business planning to make sure you know how to actually build that kind of a system that could tie together the 300 plus local units of government that ties into the existing DNR system and also makes connections to the 404 system as well, because that's currently part of our coordination element.
Mr. Norris.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just to address that a little bit, there was the concern over that cost of that online permitting system. I would point out that in the report on the table in Chapter 7 where we address fiscal impacts, it mentions that there is a $3 million cost, but it's not included in our table on fiscal impacts.
Representative Wagenius.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
You're welcome.
It seems to me that... I mean, doing things by hand is costly, and everything should be electronic by now. So we could proceed getting the electronic stuff done quickly if we decided that that would be a cost savings to everybody. We could do that, and it would not interfere with this other process, and in the end it would make it a hell of a lot easier. Take those words back. It would make it substantially easier. So I'm at a loss to understand why we're not doing all of this electronically at this point, Mr. Chair.
Representative Wagenius, two thumbs up on that. Thank you. Response, Mr. Norris or Wyrons?
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Greenius, we certainly agree with that. The primary challenge is one of resources, quite honestly, to proceed on that path.
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Wyrons, it seems that in this evaluation that you've assumed that a lot of work that's being done locally will now have to be done by the state. What prevents you from utilizing those local assets? Why can't you contract with the folks that are on the ground locally to do the work that needs to be done? They already know the territory and have done this permitting work in the past.
Mr. Wyrons.
Well, Mr. Chair, in fact, that is one of the two scenarios that are evaluated under the study is to maintain as large a share as we think we, in fact, can of that local responsibility. Part of the negotiation process with the EPA will, in fact, be what that actually looks like in the end. So we make certain assumptions in the study what that looks like, but the end results of that have yet to be determined pending that negotiation process and what the final agreement would look like with the EPA.
Representative Perkelson.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Wyron, so have you had any indication from EPA that you cannot contract with local assets?
I will start, and I think Mr. Norris may recall better, but my recollection is that there was certainly some hesitation from the EPA of how far down that path we could, in fact, go. You know, there's a certain point when that local responsibility would go too far from their perspective and what's allowed under the Clean Water Act. Mr. Chairman, I would confirm that. We did have a teleconference with EPA representatives from both EPA Region 5 and the national headquarters in Washington, and we ran several scenarios by them in terms of models for permitting in Minnesota, and they were fairly clear that most of the responsibility would have to be done at the state level. Nonetheless, the report does put a great emphasis on continuing to have a role by local governments, and we believe that there is a way to do that. But how exactly that will work will have to be done in consultation with EPA.
And if I just kind of want to add one thing here, from the board's perspective, we have seen a great deal of public value in having local governments run the Wetland Conservation Act, and certainly it's in our interest as an agency, and actually put in our mission, is to really kind of maximize that. To the extent something goes forward, how do we make that role as deep and broad as possible within the current system? Obviously, in consultation with local governments, they have to want to continue to do it, but we certainly see a great deal of value of the current system, and I think it should be maintained to the extent it can under this different world that we would have under a SUM program.
Thank you. Follow up?
Just a comment, Mr. Chair. As I look through a variety of state budgets, I see lines for consultants here, there, and everywhere. It seems like some of our best consultants might be these local folks that already know the territory.
Point well taken. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I agree with you on a point that there's change happening in Washington. And, Mr. Wyrens, you just said we could be living under a different world with 404 assumption. We don't even know if 404 will be here in a year. You know, when we read things coming out of D.C. about landing teams and beachhead teams coming into the agencies, you know, and then having to review the data or the web pages, we're in a different world. So with this discussion about assumption, we may be having to look at assumption of not just this authority that may not exist anymore, but receiving federal lands, other issues. And I would urge the agencies to think not necessarily as the past being prologue, because I think we are in a different world here. We are just because something has been doesn't mean it will be. I don't think you can count on the federal agencies to have the opinions they may have had in the past, because I think those opinions may be altered. I think we have to tread lightly here, Mr. Chair, because we actions may be happening that have repercussions that we're going to have costs that we didn't know, or we're going to have responsibilities we didn't know, or maybe we decide we don't want those responsibilities. But when things happen very quickly, as I think things are going to happen, there can be consequences that aren't not only not intended, or maybe some are intended, but that have long-ranging impacts. So I would wonder, and, you know, if in your conversations with the EPA, if you've talked to the landing teams or the beachhead teams, or if you're talking to the staff people who aren't supposed to talk to people anymore.
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Hansen, from my perspective, I'm not aware of any conversations that have occurred between Bowser staff and EPA staff. However, the exception I'd make to that is there is a, as it was referred to in the report, is a, and the title's not going to loom me, but there's a SUMA Waters committee that's currently meeting. And in fact, one of our staff are part of this national committee looking at SUMA Waters to try and give advice to the EPA. And they are currently in D.C. as we speak, trying to wrap up the work on that particular effort. I would not be surprised if conversations along the lines you're mentioning are happening there, but I'm not aware of anything that specific that's happened there in that regard.
Thank you. Representative Bliss. Or excuse me, Metza. I'm sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess I want to just speak from a bill I carried my first term and know that you were supportive as well in actually adding seven or nine, I think, at this point, somewhere in between there, FTEs. And the idea was to have the MPCA and DNR staff who work on permitting be able to work together. And some folks were reluctant when we first had it, but it's actually been successful, and now the companies in my district have really embraced it, and they're actually asking for double the staff because it's been effective in getting it done. So I just ask, as we're moving forward, to keep that in mind. I know that we share some, I guess, concerns with the delays in permitting. However, in the case of the FTEs to get it done, currently right now, I kind of consider that a separate. We've still got laws we've got to comply with on a federal level, on a state level, and it's been working great, and I'd be happy to ask some of the companies to come in and talk about that as we make decisions moving forward in this committee. So I think it is a good example of something that did work out successfully, and we're able to cut, one agency relying on another when they were able to work together like that. It really worked well. And it's more in response to what you were talking about. And I did want to just say it's working, and I share some of the same concerns that you do as well. But I did think that it was prudent to bring it up because I think the companies would be pretty disappointed if some of those staff disappeared right now or they didn't have the opportunity to get it through to fruition. We've got a lot of larger permits underway right now with MNTAC, and I would hope that those folks are able to stay in and keep doing that work because it is helping move it along much quicker than it was before.
Representative Bliss.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And following up to Representative Mensa and Representative Green, I had a question. I don't think there's any question that additional employees will be needed because of the additional responsibilities you're picking up. My question is something that the other gentleman comment he made about the number of employees that the Corps is currently using sounds very similar to your number that you added to your budget. My question is that all they're doing at the Corps is working on projects for Minnesota?
Mr. Norris.
Thank you, Chair. Representative, the Corps has several different branches, and I'm not really sure what the scope of your question is. Their regulatory branch, they are primarily involved in issuing Section 404 permits and Section 10 permits under the Rivers and Harbors Act, which apply to navigable waters. Now, the Corps, the St. Paul District, has other branches that deal with construction projects, habitat improvement projects, and so forth. But the number that I cited, the 49 to 53, were the staff that are involved with permitting in Minnesota.
Okay.
Does that address your question?
I guess the second part of that is that if we do eliminate that from their job description or what they do, there would be no duplication of effort, so we wouldn't be able to pare that number down a bit when we move it over to the Minnesota Department. And I guess, in the private sector, when you do consolidate, the first thing you look at is the reduction of duplication of efforts and reducing costs. And I just wonder if that's something you looked at.
Mr. Irons or Norris?
Well, maybe I'll start. Part of your question might be, to the extent that the Corps has less work to do because Minnesota's waters, they in theory might reduce their staff. But that has no relationship with what happens at the state level. If it's $1 million of reduced expense, throw a number out, that $1 million would not be coming to Minnesota offset our costs. I mean, there's no money to subsidize our work going on there as well. So that'd be kind of their management decision of how their duties change, what's their workload needed. In the same fashion, we try to analyze what do we think our workloads would be, and therefore our staffing needs under an assumed program. We're trying to include in this report is that level of estimate to try and make sure we're doing the job well and doing it timely.
Representative Bliss.
Just one quick follow-up. Yeah, I understand that they wouldn't be transferring the money over to you, but it just seems like the numbers match, and it sounds like you're just taking the effort and putting it into your budget instead of reducing the duplication of efforts on your side. That's my question.
Commissioner Wirens, Director Wirens,
response. Well, Mr. Chair, and Representative, I guess We took a separate analysis of what we think the workload requirements are to arrive at our numbers without any regard to what the core staffing is now or might be in the future. Try to do our best job to estimate what things required to get the job done. The fact numbers, at least on the high end, are in that same ballpark, really are nothing more than coincidence. There was no relationship as part of that analysis.
Mr. Irons, if that analysis that you did is not included in the 130-page document, if you have more written analysis on how you arrived at that number of 23 to 53, I'd like to see that. Representative Wagenius, is it your question to this point? Then we're going to go to Representative Becker-Finn, please.
My question's already been answered.
Thank you. Well, then we're going to Representative Wagenius.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Warren. As we've been having this discussion, it seems to me there's an underlying assumption that permittees pay the full cost of what it is to permit their project, both in you and DNR. Is that true? And if not, how much does the state taxpayer subsidize those permits?
Gentlemen.
Well, that's a complicated question, Mr. Chair, and Representative Guineas. I speak somewhat to WACA and how it currently works in that most local governments do, in fact, charge permit fees. Do they, in fact, cover the full cost of their work? That's not likely because, in fact, we do provide grants to counties for their work in administering the Conservation Act, but $1.9 million per year, I believe, is the dollar amount we provide annually to support that work that goes directly to counties for purposes of the Conservation Act. So perhaps directly to your question, you should consider that amount of funding really as a subsidy of the regulatory process. We don't have data on fee revenue collected by counties in terms of permit fee, application fees, but in terms of cost the state has, the board has, we derive no direct application fees from permittees for our work in supporting that local system.
Follow up, Representative Wagenius.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So you've given us the number for how much taxpayers give to counties to subsidize the fees. It would be helpful for you and DNR to provide for us the amount of money that you expend that is not supported by fees. So we just need a clear picture of what's going on here, Mr. Chair. It's murky to me right now.
Thank you, and I'm sure that they'll make that available to us. I see a couple of heads nodding.
Well, in fact, Mr. Chair, I believe the information that you're looking for is on page 63 of the report that kind of lays out in table format. It lays out what the current costs are, and perhaps that has the information you're looking for, Representative Guineas, is on page 63 of the report itself.
Thank you. Anything else for the benefit of the group? And what day is today? Thursday? Yeah, so we'll meet again on Tuesday morning.